two-day session. I'm really happy to welcome all of you here. My name is Ferenc Hörtel. I'm the director of the Institute of Philosophy of the Research Center of the Humanities of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. Long name for a small institute, but small and strong in its interests and in its research potentials. And I'm happy to be part of that team. And this is more particularly the event of the research group, which is focusing on political philosophy and moral philosophy. That's the organizing part in our institute. But the event itself, which is the event of political realism and practical morality, was co-organized by two nice and helpful research institutions, one of them being the Institute for Political Science of the Hungarian Academy of Science, just on the other side of the court here, and the other one is it the Doctoral School of Corvinus University? Yes, the Doctoral School in Political Theory of Corvinus University, one of the best in town. So that's the co-organizing committee or institution, and John told me to talk as fast as possible. So let me turn now to him. It's a real pleasure to welcome here Professor John Dunn from Cambridge University, England, who is a professor in political theory and one of the acclaimed Cambridge School, which they deny to exist or to have existed, but he is one of the best known representatives of that circle. And his interests are both in ancient or well, the long story of democracy from ancient up to modern political theory, and in particular, he is also interested in the British tradition, in the early modern British tradition of political thought, like in John Locke. Characteristic understanding and interpretation of law. He is one of our keynote speakers, so he will take part in the 2 days, and I'm happy to have him here. It's a real pleasure and an honor to have him, and I don't want to take his time. He said that he would talk about 45 to 50 minutes, and then we are going to take questions and comments. So, John, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Ferry. I'm going to speak sitting down, if I may, because I've got a text and I won't be able to read it if I'm standing up. So there's a strong reason to bring it up. If you can't hear me at the back, the wave vigorously or the shout at me, it's completely impossible to hear me. But I will try to remain audible. It's a great pleasure to be back in Budapest. I've got very special reasons for being interested in the fate of this country. It's very nice to be in this particular building, which I understand the inhabitants of which are in imminent danger of deportation and elsewhere. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I'm very much looking forward to these 2 days. I'm going to talk about something which I think should have a bearing, however weak, on the interests of everybody who's come for this occasion, because of the scope of what we're supposed to be thinking about over these 2 days. But I'm going to talk about it from a very specific angle, which won't immediately be the angle which probably anywhere anyone else here is thinking about it from. And I'm going to try and assert the merits of thinking about it from that particular angle, obviously. The title of what I'm going to say is Indeterminate Primacy, and it's about the relationship between domestic politics and international relations. as that relationship has been thought about over a very long delay in the history of the West, wherever the West is. As you know, it's spread. Maybe contracted now, but it's spread. So, here it goes. Methodology is the death of thought and the inveterate and mortal foe of political comprehension. Learning to understand politics through study and effort is a slow and hazardous exercise, and one in which it's easy to exaggerate the level of success anyone ever achieves. Political scientists commit themselves by vocation to an endless exercise in methodological self-awareness and varying the gracious mutual criticism. Like everyone else, they must struggle as best they can to comprehend, but they must try too, and it's essentially the same time, but soon afterwards anyway, to do so on a basis which will vindicate the validity of their conclusions about what are allegedly the same phenomena over the competing claims of others who understand them quite differently. The quest for that basis is the search for a method which can be self-validating in application. There are perhaps such methods, or at least powerful candidates for them, but what enables them to be self-validating is their formal character. Political comprehension does not have a formal character, so in application to politics, they must always depend on prior and independent political comprehension and be, in the last instance, always potentially quite off the point. Historians of political thought don't need anything of the kind and are, in my view, ill-advised to try to find one. And it's unclear to me how students of international relations can be any better advised to look for anything of the sort. Obviously, that's a fairly contentious thing. Since we're meeting as historians of political thought or students of international relations, I'm going to discuss a topic that's necessarily central to each discipline as an academic endeavour, as it was and continues to be for the problems of practical judgment, out of which each discipline arose in the first place and still draws those who aspire to study it. The question I want to address is how far it's right to see the external relations of a state and its political community as determined by the internal relations, economic, social, and political, between its members, and how far it's right instead to see its central political choices and the trajectory of its political life as determined by the vagaries and exigencies of its relations with other states and with the dynamics of a global economy. If either political science or international relations had discovered a self-validating method which was genuinely politically instructive, each would certainly by now have found out which of those two views is correct, or more plausibly, in my view, discovered that neither is close to the truth, precisely because the causal relationship between the two shifts constantly, and it barely makes sense to suppose that for any extended span of time it could settle down solidly and stably on one side rather than the other. Much of the last century and a half, the intellectual and sometimes even the political running between the two in assessing their rival claims to dominance were set by an intellectual tradition united only in deference to the legacy of Karl Marx. Both the demerits and the strengths of that tradition are all too familiar to Hungarians of a certain age. For a variety of reasons, my own thinking about the balance between internal and external factors in shaping community's political experience was heavily marked both by the salience of that intellectual tradition and by the very personal impact of a great Hungarian scholar, recently deceased and for long a colleague of mine, István Pont. István himself was never chose to describe his own obsessive preoccupations in those terms, but I think they capture them very well, and they help to show both why the upshot of his thinking is so potent and why it's proved so very hard to summarise, either for himself or for anyone else. István certainly did have a method in the sense of a readily recognisable and consistent approach. But so far from viewing it as self-validating, And despite the ready contempt with which he often dismissed the interpretive efforts of others, he had the greatest difficulty in reaching judgments which he was happy to express in the mercilessly durable medium of print. It often seemed that his real conviction was that omniscience is a necessary condition for knowledge, so that whenever his conclusions threatened to enter print, he became weighed down with the fear that there might be something else of which he was as yet unaware, which might subsequently prove him wrong. I once heard a prominent Oxford historian of Christianity, auditioned by potential colleagues in Cambridge for the Regis Chair of History, the grandest local post in the teaching of history, asked by a much younger scholar, as it happens, German and female, towards the end of his interview, which was a quite new format for succession to such a lofty office. They used to be assigned on a political basis and definitely arcanely and strict privacy, but this was a relatively public choice process. Asked towards the end of his interview what his methodology was, responds after a lengthy pause for thought, "I suppose I just try to be very, very careful." Perhaps a readily intelligible intellectual precaution over such an inflammatory topic, since his own most recent major work at the time was a magnificent biography of certainly the last, and as far as I know, the only Archbishop of Canterbury to have been burnt alive. Isfahan's method, too, was certainly to be very, very careful, although it didn't sound like that, and to go on being so long after diminishing returns had set in. For all the vigour, trenchancy, sweep, and incisiveness with which he never hesitated to assert his conclusions orally to audiences in both Cambridge and both Cambridges and across the world, either side of the Atlantic, sadly few of those conclusions were permitted to reach print in his own lifetime. The result, almost inevitably, is that the upshot of his intellectual life is far less well known than it richly deserves to be. Isfahan was a close, if infuriating, friend and colleague of mine with brief intervals for over a third of a century. So I speak about him in this, which is so much his home city, with great pleasure. But I do so not for the pleasure itself, but in order to insist on the massive importance of his work for historians of political thought in the West and students of international relations. And above all, for anyone who seriously tries to identify and take the measure of the tense and elusive relations between the two. In the 57 years since I first came to Cambridge, I've known quite a number of great scholars there and elsewhere across the world, historians, philosophers, economists, even anthropologists or political scientists. Most of them have already left, or will in due course leave behind them, far larger and more finished oeuvre than Isfahan was able to. I naturally can't judge how fluently he expressed himself in Magyar, but certainly in English he also wrote far less elegantly or commandingly than most of them. But I don't think any of them produced work which matters more for anyone who's trying to understand the development of political thinking in modern history, or the relations between states, societies, and economies across the world, which that thinking has long been shaping itself. What enabled him to do so was his remarkable intelligence and his quite astonishing energy when he chose to apply it. But what drove him to deploy those gifts with as sharp a focus and such fierce passion was a harshly aversive political experience which he had every reason to take very personally. Anyone with an admired father as minister in Hungary's post-war communist government had good reason to become a political skeptic. But by itself, that impulse might readily have yielded merely a jaded nihilism. In this form, it produced instead a potent and lifelong will to understand, and understand in particular quite why his parents' youthful hopes had come to be so miserably disappointed, and what other shapes of hope for the human future, not least politically, there was good reason to entertain in their place. To do so, he first turned back to the formation of political economy, the analytical tradition which Marx saw as offering the key, however imaginatively distorted by the exigencies of ideology, to the very different and decisively superior form of collective future he anticipated for the human species. To fathom the processes through which that way of thinking came to be fashioned, this fund focused initially on two luminaries of the Scottish Enlightenment. The first was David Hume, the dazzling sceptical philosopher who haunted the Oxford philosophers of my youth. It was Hume's spectacular bestseller, The History of Great Britain, which has been studied for his doctorate within this academy, and which I'm confident by the time he died, he understood better than anyone else had done since Hume wrote it. The second, more conventionally, was Adam Smith, intellectual hero of the champions of capitalism from Milton Friedman to Margaret Thatcher, and of course, the former people too. That phase of Isfahan's work was quicker to reach a wider audience than much that came later, with his co-edited volume, Wealth and Virtue, drawing close attention in Europe, North America, and as far away as Japan. The central message of Wealth and Virtue wasn't just the richness and density of perfection that went into Hume's and Smith's vision of the economies of England, Scotland, and their European counterparts, but also, and just as importantly, how intensely and intelligently political were the concerns which prompted them to form it. Isfahan's initial intention had been to follow the trail, the mode of thinking they'd done so much to develop, outward to England, France, and Germany, and forward towards Marx's response. But he never reached Marx himself by that route, and it wasn't apparent to anyone else, and quite probably wasn't even to Isfahan, quite what he was trying to do instead. There was an interval of more than two decades between his first and second books, and the second, the massive volume Jealousy of Trade, although it made a considerable impact from the outset and won prizes from the American Political Science Association and historians of economic thought, didn't decisively clarify the answer. Even his posthumously published Carlyle lectures at Oxford, Jealousy of Trade, provided no precise summation. And alongside John's story, it brought within every view of any patient and attentive reader how Isfahan himself had come to see the implications of his lifetime's quest. The core elements of his vision were caught in the terms of his two titles, the necessarily and irresolvably tense domestic politics of every commercial society, and the unstable and endlessly provocative relations between states, citizens, producers, and consumers in any global economy so far envisaged, let alone any thus far actualized, perhaps too, at all likely to be created in the future. We could perhaps say, without absurdity, that he was trying to show what it is about the world we've long been living in that has made possible two momentous political events of the present year, Britain's Brexit referendum in June and America's mesmerizing presidential election this very month. This was a deeply realist vision, but it was a vision grounded in structural analysis of each domain and derived from several decades of intense historical research, not one extrapolated tautologically from any set of scholastic categories. Was also one formed through intellectual cooperation with an ever-widening range of fellow scholars across the world, often very close, and sometimes persisting over more than three decades. That research had taken him far backwards in time from the Scotland of the Enlightenment and forwards up to the minute as he watched the world's economy, erratic and sometimes convulsive development. I think he must have had the instinct for what to look for from the outset. Certainly he had it when I first met him in Cambridge late in the 1970s, and I assume he acquired it at home, in this city, in dialogue with his highly political and demandingly intellectual family. What was most striking in retrospect was the delicacy and precision of his response to these kaleidoscopic fields, the sheer veracity of his intellectual curiosity and the depth of his epistemological skepticism. There could, in his view, be no serviceable abridgment of it with any degree of reliability. It was histoire totale with a vengeance, but thought with the sweep and assurance of Hegel or the youthful Marx. Not with the literary, as it were, force of either, unfortunately. That combination of audacity with skeptical intransigence, allied to a considerable rhetorical flair on his feet, made him an inspiring but devastating teacher and greatly alarmed a fair proportion of his fellow scholars. To form that fiercely totalizing vision, Isfahan drew with vigor and gratitude on much that had been done by others in Cambridge in the history of Western political thought. He greatly admired, already by the time he arrived in Cambridge, the work of Duncan Forbes on Hume and Smith, and throughout his subsequent life paid close, if skeptical, attention to the massive exertions of John Pocock into the Roman backgrounds of European Republican thinking. He worked closely for decades with Michael Sonnenscher on French thought of the later 17th and 18th centuries, and he inspired a string of talented and assiduous doctoral pupils, mostly if not in the British Isles. Above all, he thought and argued incessantly in dialogue with Richard Tuck, now at Harvard, as Richard's work unfolded from natural rights theories and philosophy of government to the rights of war and peace, free riding, and the speaking sovereign. For each, the key element of political understanding was the central preoccupation of the natural jurisprudence tradition, the political implications of the imperfection of human sociality. Richard was undoubtedly the person from whom it was composed. It's important for my theme that what Isfahan derived from their exchanges was so very different. Isfahan placed everything that he learned in the service of one overwhelming will to understand and convey to others what he had understood. You can measure the contrast between their two purposes in Richard Tuck's pronouncement on the Brexit referendum. It's impossible to imagine Isfahan pressing a public case on an issue certain to have such a deep impact on the life chances of most of those who voted in either direction with such blithe disregard for the economic consequences of the outcome. From very many of these colleagues, and Richard most of all, Isfahan drew extensively as a kind of work community, but it never occurred to him that what was valuable in what they contrived to produce was the product of their access to a definite and distinctively felicitous method of inquiry, a view unlikely to occur on purely inductive grounds to anyone who spent several decades in Cambridge studying the history of political thought. That's about the Cambridge School. So much then for the scope of his oeuvre, the academic sources on which he drew, and the character of his personal impact. But what exactly, by the end and after so much effort, did he have to say? What were his conclusions, or as scientists like to think of them, his results? That was certainly a question which preoccupied those who disliked or feared him, as it was the not inconsiderable number whom he merely irritated intensely. But it was a question, too, which naturally also concerned his students and closer intellectual colleagues. The former might think of him, as some assuredly did, as just a much noisier and altogether more intimidating counterpart to George Eliot's Castlebon, a figure engaged in a lifelong quest for the key to all the mysteries, who had never found and was never in any danger of finding anything that really mattered at all. That last judgment was very seriously mistaken, but it's not easy to show just why. I don't believe that anyone could be wise to summarize the conclusion of anyone who spent several energetic decades conspicuously failing to summarize for himself. But I think there were a number of clear and quite steady elements in his thinking over the whole period from which I knew him. And while he had certainly come to know vastly more about the variety of historical expressions of each by the time he died, I doubt if he ever hoped that they could be captured in simple and authoritative formula, still less that he might himself be able to express them that way. In that sense, the image of Casaubon in Middlemarch was in this deeply unjust one. But there was nevertheless something Sisyphean, even something inherently futile, in what he was attempting to do. One way of summarizing that would be that he was trying to show himself and anyone else willing to listen how far the political thinking of the West had got, and where and why and how, in his judgment, throughout the decades in which I knew him, it had got stuck, reached limits which it simply couldn't go beyond. And because it had done so, increasingly fragmented and dissipated into shreds and tatters of comprehension, very much the condition in which we find ourselves today, as I expect you've all noticed. Some scholars, more ingenuous or more readily satisfied, who tried anything like as hard as this firm had to grasp quite how this great logjam of disordered thought had come about, might have tried to demonstrate what had caused this failure through a set of quite abstract conceptual formulae, especially if their youths had been as saturated in the writings of Kant, Hegel, and Marx as Isfahan's were. But that wasn't at all Isfahan's way. His approach, rather, was to go through the endless array of historical experiences which might have had some bearing on the outcome, and do so in exhaustive detail, to show the logjam inexorably piling up. You can read his conclusion quite clearly in the closing pages of Politics and Commercial Society. The logjam was fully there by the close of the 18th century. The great European political thinkers of the 19th century, and still more the distinctly less great European political thinkers of the century that followed, of course introduced many interesting new ideas, but none broke through and escaped it. None ever travelled effectively beyond it. Those who learned from this time learned to watch this process of cumulative frustration through sharpened understanding across many different historical settings, and to build up a practiced judgment of what to look for, and a keen sense of just how and why each fresh and audacious intellectual initiative was bound to get stuck and peter out. That's not at all the sort of thing which people go out into the wilderness to see, but it may just be all that's to be found there. In my view, Isfahan came as close as anyone could to showing why it just is. To follow his demonstration, you had to follow his footsteps and see the dilemmas he kept identifying, as he always did, as blockages in very active efforts at understanding, many of which had enjoyed significant if partial success along the way. That was an intensely dynamic view of intellectual history, with a tension poised throughout between recognition of the shared effort embodied in thinking of any power and a stern epistemic appraisal of just what that effort had proved able to produce. He could never have been a Whig interpreter of the history of political thought, because he attached no special value to the present, and as far as I know, never expressed serious convictions about the future. But like the great Whig historians, his principal interest in studying the past was to identify the reach and limits of his achievements, and he took his criterion for assessing these quite audibly and without apology from his own judgment. That's a highly exposed position, and one which is apt to set a historian's teeth on edge. And since Isfahan himself was not an especially modest person, it could readily seem arrogant and unself-aware, both personally and historically. But there was nothing arrogant about the approach itself. It treated the thought of the past in a resolutely egalitarian spirit as passages in a common struggle to understand. Like Machiavelli on his country estate, though with a rather less sartorial self-consciousness, Isfahan thought politics through endlessly in the company of thinkers long gone, and he treated their thinking with the closest attention and with deep respect. The twin foci of his inquiry, as I try to convey, were on the distinctive sources of conflict and the persisting challenges to legitimacy intrinsic to a commercial society, and the external strains and far less abundant reconciliatory resources inherent in international trade. Underlying both, this is actually, as it were, the theme of the hour, that's what I'm trying to show you. Underlying both, and intruding persistently into each, was the fundamental deficit in human sociality, explored so assiduously in the political thinking of what we still think of as the West, from the time of Plato and Aristotle to that of Kant and Hegel, and most consequentially for his time in the natural jurisprudence of European thinkers from Grotius to Pufendorf and their 18th century commentators. For all of this, Isbern developed a considerable mastery. But there were, of course, zones in the history of political thought into which he didn't care to go. One of the most important of these was certainly the history of religion, which he tended to view with Lucretian disdain, but which certainly had an elemental impact on European thinking about politics for most of the period between Constantine and Alexis de Tocqueville, and which, as we've recently been reminded, of, can be most unwise to neglect. By the beginning of the 17th century, that world, as this one thought of it, had become unmistakably the world of and for Europeans. Not, of course, for all of them, or for any all of the time, but still the framework within which Europe's states and their subjects must conduct their lives and struggle to sustain themselves from then on. For most elements of the life chances of most of them, it was still a very weak force field, but it was beginning to strengthen, and crucially, the possibility of simply opting out of it and living in lofty solitude to fly at this regard of it was already vanishing. Even in the Alpine mountains, where John Milton called on God to avenge the slaughtered saints of the Valdenses, slain by the bloody Piedmontese, communities which had hidden from history with some success for centuries were no longer beyond the reach of counter-reformation monastic statehood. From then on, for all the sometimes massive disruptions of world wars or lengthy depressions, it's continued to tighten ever since. It's no more likely to turn back durably for Donald Trump or David Davis than the North Sea tide was for King Canute. For Isbern, this was simply the setting of modern politics, and he could not take seriously any more partial or myopic alternative. The only choice that mattered to him was the choice between recognizing that peremptory fact and trying to gauge what it means, or forensically ignoring it or pretending not to recognize it. Isbern himself didn't use the category of modern politics because he refused to employ a terminology alien to his historical subjects and interlocutors, and it wouldn't be accurate to claim that he thought in just those terms. In my view, they summarize what, by the stage I knew him, had definitely become his presuppositions. 17th century dispute between the ancients and the moderns was less a political division than a choice of temporal horizons and a disagreement about the prime location of intellectual value. It was a matter more of cognitive strategy than personal allegiance. The idea of a commercial society served to pick out prominent aspects of the lives of trading cities in Europe and beyond for several centuries. But it wasn't until the 18th century that it became the prime candidate for analysing the future of Europe and, in due course, most of the rest of the world. It didn't initially assume an analytic shape with any definite political armature, and it never acquired the sheer power to dictate its own political setting. But once it had moved to the centre of European history, as Hume and Smith both clearly recognised that had, it restricted the scope of political possibilities from then on. And we still have no idea at all of what it could be like for human beings to live in a world which has passed beyond it or come to destroy it. We've been exploring the political plasticity of commercial society across the world with varying felicity ever since, by invention or imitation as well as by compulsions, through the great world wars and revolutions as much as through the creation and operations of the main coordinating institutions of world politics and world economics League of Nations, the United Nations, the European Union, the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO. By now, perhaps through the proliferating operations of the vast internet corporations, Microsoft, Amazon, Yahoo, Facebook, and so on. Throughout that fraught process, the balance between shared and conflicting interests has remained deeply obscure, and mutual judgments of how best to define them have remained intensely provocative and contentious. The early 18th century hope that trade, du commerce, might soften and detoxify relations between states and peoples has proved hopelessly sanguine. And the ever more heavily armed interpretations of the political structures best fitted to police it on their subjects' behalf have continued to view each other with suspicion and mutual contempt. The state of the world commercial society has made, with scarcely an exception, have claimed to police their subjects' relations with the world beyond their borders for the former's material benefit. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the Islamic Republic of Iran, or the Democratic and Popular Republic of Korea, as much so as Singapore or Luxembourg, or indeed the United States of America. The proudest boast of China's Communist Party government is to have done so over the last three decades with an unprecedented world historical success, fully befitting the world's oldest and proudest civilization. In recent history, only perhaps the Khmer Rouge, the Taliban government in Afghanistan, and perhaps the ISIS caliphate have seriously claimed anything diametrically opposite. That's unsurprising and less than informative about the political character or upshot of any of those regimes. But it does, in my view, show that Islam was fundamentally right in two very large-scale judgments, that by the 18th century, commercial society had won the power to set terms to any form of durable political community and simply excluded over time, any length of time, any alternative approach, either to making and sustaining a political community or determining its relations with those beyond its borders. For Adam Smith, as for Marx and indeed Deng Xiaoping, the creation of a world of commercial societies was a profoundly transformative process. But each was well aware that there was nothing inherently calm and reassuring about the history it would generate. Islam, like it's reasonable to assume Deng Xiaoping, was quite sure there was no safer, gentler, and more orderly world waiting steadily beyond it. Within the logic of this new world, there were four fundamental sources of normative and practical instability. Together, this one they added up, in one of his more flamboyant and pregnant phrases, to the permanent crisis of a divided mankind. The first, on which Smith was somewhat oversanguine, Marx prospectively more than a little obscure, and Deng Xiaoping very wisely kept his thoughts to himself, was the domestic basis of legitimacy and political authority. The second was the basis on which the producers and consumers in any commercial society were to trade with those of any other. The third was the way in which the states, which must guarantee the property orders of every commercial society, were to handle their more acute conflicts with one another. The fourth, every bit as deep, was the normative force and cogency of those property orders themselves. For each of those problems, over more than 2,500 years, thinkers in many different countries have tried to construct imaginatively compelling solutions, some far more enduring than others. What no one has yet contrived to do is to devise even minimally alluring approaches to all four, which fit plausibly and naturally together. Until someone does, you can, I think, be confident that that permanent crisis is going to run on. And even if someone ever does do so, it's reasonable to doubt that there's much chance of the history of the world listening patiently to their solution and adjusting its frenzied rhythms to the reconciliatory potentiality it claims to offer. It's one thing learning what the spell needs to be, and quite another to muster the power to cast it. I'll say a very little about each of those four sources and then conclude by explaining why, in my view, taken together, they ensure that no human community from now on would have good reason for confidence that the most pressing threats to its safety will come from inside it or press on it from outside, and its density therefore be principally determined by its own agency or instead by others at varying distances away. The principal ideological boast of Western countries until very recently was to have eliminated the first source and solved the problem of legitimacy and authorization by installing universal adult suffrage free elections as the mechanism for deriving their governments. That was never a well-founded judgment, and anyone who believes it valid at present must have missed most of the news for at least the last 9 months. The protectionist revanchement over the same period, which has convulsed the politics of Britain, the United States and France, has underlined how far we still are from eliminating the second source and confirmed the fairly obvious truth that open trading frontiers are bound sooner or later to dismay those who trade across them ineffectually. The impact of that dismay on the Brexit referendum and the presidential electoral campaigns Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have stunned the political classes of Europe and North America, obviously the political class in this country less. The slowing of China's economy and the vast chasm of unfunded debt that slowing has opened up has inflamed its territorial militancy across the China seas, deepened the weight of its domestic repression, and underlined just how far we remain from eliminating the third source normative and practical instability. There's no good reason to see any of those three sources of instability merely as a product of either of the others. But more plausible claims have long been made for the primacy of the fourth, the basis on which humans in one setting or another have come to appropriate the earth and use its fruits in one another's labour. Isfahan spent decades probing the history of Western theories of property, and he drew from them two conclusions: that no conception of justice in initial acquisition would furnish a compelling conception of justice in transfer within a commercial society, and that that alone was sufficient to preclude the application of distributive justice as either an intuitively plausible or a practical coherent criterion for the workings of any commercial society. So much for modern political philosophy. No vision of initial appropriation could validate the working of a real economy or eliminate dismay at its distributive consequences for those who lived from and through it. The promise of a world in which the claims of distributive justice were permanently assuaged or rendered irrelevant was wholly bogus, an ignoble lie which discredited anyone who sought political power on the pretext of realizing it. In that respect, the political message which issued from his analysis was almost wholly negative, but no less weighty for that. The vision he reached for constantly was one he sought because he hoped and struggled to convey it to others. It was a skill in very active understanding, not a set of theses to nail onto any sacred door to be duly deferred to by anyone. He saw the history of political thinking in the West as a great but painfully finite achievement, and an achievement of clear universal import. It took some decades to persuade him that the history of political thinking anywhere else especially mattered, except perhaps as a source of danger. And I don't think he was ever convinced that it might contribute seriously to understanding the fundamental challenges of human collective life. I certainly think he must hope that eventually does. In that sense, he was a very European kind of cosmopolitan, after all, the European category in the first place. The political thinking of the West from Athens onwards has massively prioritized the shaping and stabilization of a domestic political community. And it's continued to do so despite the long-lasting impact of Rome's empire and its would-be descendants, or the dynamic claims of the latter's rivals. Universal monarchy was an unpromising political project, not least because it was never in prospective application a minimally plausible political idea. There's no reason to see this priority of the domestic as an intellectual practical error. Much the same priority has been given to the substance of political thinking of China or the Islamic world, whatever the global attitude of their pretensions to. But it's proved, and it's certain to continue to prove, a source of acute political vulnerability, and a vulnerability which is bound to increase relentlessly and as more and more of the huge dangers that human beings have created for each other can be tamed and brought back under human control only by tight, reliable, and necessarily intricate agreements between huge populations with widely contrasting histories and cultures. We approach the problems of political choice and strategy, as we must and we don't know how to, through local political institutions and capabilities, and on the basis of our still fairly parochial historical awareness. But the world we need to deal with has for very long now been largely beyond the reach of any of those. Even the Western political thinkers most alert to the destabilizing pressure of the outside on domestic order and prosperity, and most sensitive to the impulses to project power beyond it, Machiavelli, Weber, Lenin, never hit on a means to assert the primacy of the domestic, and even those like Joseph Stalin, who reasserted the need vehemently and without apology, sacrificed most of the grounds which gave point of dignity to their political energies precisely by doing so. Workers of the World Unite had some sporadic contextual plausibility as a slogan of the political insurgency, but it never suggested minimally plausible institutional reforms for doing so anywhere for any length of time, let alone permanently and over the globe as a whole. Governing the world as or through a political community remains as forlorn a political project as it's always been threadbare as a political idea. So, over what aspects, if any, did Islam's work alter the way in which we should see those relations? He never made the slightest attempt to do so by setting out a novel and systematic scheme of understanding with the least pretension to intellectual hegemony, let alone practical hegemony. He didn't assert either a new or an old primacy of the external over the internal, either causally or in political response.